The State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs Conference Committee will come to order. First item of the, on the agenda tonight is a discussion of Article 1, the rider language differences. Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair and members, I believe that in your packets is an index to some of the language differences in Article 1. And the intent here is, knowing that later you're going to be making decisions on the spreadsheet items, there are some of these rider issues that will not automatically be decided by your financial decisions. And so the purpose of this memo is just to point out some of those language items for your consideration. And these are organized in order that they appear. And the first group is in the legislature, and the first difference is on page R3. And this memo does not point out things that are purely financial and that will be settled by your spreadsheet decisions. So on the top of page R3 on the Senate side, the Senate has a rider that breaks out a specific amount for the legislative auditor under the LCC appropriation. And the House does not have that language. The House just has a general appropriation for all of the entities and offices under the jurisdiction of the LCC.
Okay. And Mr. Lundin, was that just the approach that you were taking, or was there a different, was there a specific reason?
Madam Chair, I believe that the reason that we broke out the legislative auditor is because we gave them a larger increase in appropriation than the rest of the LCC. We gave them a 14%, whereas the LCC got a 9%. So that's why we put a rider in.
Madam Chair,
Senator Saxon.
It was a little bit of the MMB was concerned that they have a yearly audit done by the old OLA, and the OLA didn't think that it probably necessarily with its current number of employees had, you know, time to do that. So we said, well, let's get some more employees, and MMB, you should be able to count on that situation. So that's why the increase.
If at any time someone has something to add that wants to give us more information, you're welcome to stand up. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, the next difference that I note is on the bottom of page R3 on the Senate side. The Senate designates $10,000 of the appropriation to the Legislative Coordinating Commission for a legislators' forum.
And Senator Saxhog?
And Madam Chair, over the last, it's been at least 10 years now, there has been a tradition of International Legislators Forum, which is a gathering of representatives from both the House and the Senate, both sides of the aisle, meeting in either with North Dakota, South Dakota, and the province of Manitoba, and talking about things that we have in common, whether they be water or international relations or agriculture or whatever. I think it's, I've been on the steering committee, although I wasn't always in. And Representative Lanning was a key member of that for many years.
I remember.
Yeah.
And where is it going to be?
This year it will be in Winnipeg.
When is it? Not in January.
No, in June. We'll give you the opportunity, Madam Chair. It is fun, particularly in Winnipeg, I think.
I love that place that has some. It's a Swiss place, and they have that thing on the stick that you put in the cheese.
Yeah. Fondue.
Yeah. Mr.
Madam Chair, it's about 2.5 days, and it's pretty intensive. But there is, you do meet in a lot of very interesting places.
Duluth?
We haven't met in Duluth yet. Actually, the last 2 years ago, we met in Moorhead, and the reason for that is because Minnesota couldn't travel out of state.
Oh.
And we didn't want everybody to have to come to St. Paul, although 3 years previous to that, we met in St. Mm-hmm. Paul. You alternate each year.
Yeah, okay. And then there's a circuit that,
right.
You know, South Dakota, North Dakota, Canada, Minnesota.
Right.
Yeah. I didn't know that before. Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair, the next item is on the House side of the same page, R3, and this was requires a $139,000 per year transfer from the LCC's operations budget to the legislative auditor's budget. This was mentioned earlier as part of the House's treatment of the Sunset Commission issue, and when the House, like the Senate, proposed abolishing the Sunset Commission, the House transferred this money to the legislative auditor and requested the audit commission to use the money to conduct additional evaluations of agencies.
Any question? Please continue.
On the next one, Madam Chair, is on page R4, moving on to, on R4 on the top of the page on the Senate side. The Senate authorizes the LCC to provide money for NCSL purposes up to $100,000 to prepare for the annual conference being held in Minneapolis next year.
Do you have any more information about the preparations, Senator?
No. Do you have any more information on that, Mr. Lundin?
This was a request that we put in the bill. I think it was at the request of Senator Pappas.
Oh, yes.
And we can always ask Greg Hubinger for some more information on it if we want. But, I mean, basically it's providing some cash flow for the upcoming conference.
Mr. Hubinger, want to come up and help us, Madam Chair?
Thank you. I don't know. She's doing that at one this year, but I don't know who's doing
the Midwest.
Who's doing the NCSL? Yeah. I'm not sure, but Mr. Hubinger knows, I bet. Welcome. Can you give us more details of what this money is for? Because apparently we're having NCSL in Minneapolis next year or the following year.
Madam Chair, as Mr. Lundin indicated, this is a request from Senator Pappas, as Vice Chair of the LCC, to front this fund, these funds as a loan to NCSL for startup activities related to the NCSL conference in Minneapolis in 2014. The intent would be for the NCSL to use these funds for startup activities and then eventually repay them to the LCC.
And what do you mean? Do you know what they mean by startup activities?
Madam Chair, as I understand it, the Minnesota delegation is responsible for a luncheon at this year's conference in Atlanta to advertise the conference here the following year. And it's for that activity and other activities related to the organizing efforts for 2014.
Okay, are there any other questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Saxon represents Saxon. Senator Saxon. Tom.
The co-chair with Senator Pappas is Representative and Speaker Thiessen.
Oh.
And apparently the other expense that is important is having a booth in Atlanta prior to the coming up here.
Okay. Thank you. And that costs $100,000.
And Madam Chair, as somebody said here, it's going to be paid back by fundraising.
Oh, mm-hmm. Oh, so that's what you meant by cash flow?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, the next item is in the Governor's Office on page R5 on line 4.14 on the Senate side, 4.19 on the House side. The fiscal staff mentioned this when walking through the bill the other day, that this has to do with the amount of money that the Governor's Office is allowed to receive from other executive agencies. And the Senate increased this to $750,000. The House has the $720,000 from which I believe was last biennium's number.
Madam Chair, the thing
Senator Sackson,
can I give you the thinking here? Is that rather than eliminate it, we just, we thought maybe if we increased it slightly that the governor would be happier. So that's the thinking.
Okay. Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair and members, Matt Mossman, I have had some discussion with the governor's office about this provision, and the governor's position is that the rider language limiting the amount is unnecessary, that there's, sorry if I'm speaking into the mic, that there is transparency in the reporting and the putting it in the special revenue fund that would be some self-policing of this amount, and that he would oppose the cap on the amount itself.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome, Madam Chair, members. Happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Shepherd, Attorney General.
Yes, Madam Chair, on page R6, the Senate on lines 5.6 to 5.11 specifies that $65,000 each year of the appropriation to the Attorney General is for a grant to the County Attorneys Association for prosecutor and law enforcement training, and the House does not have that language.
Senator, what does that
mean? Madam Chair, Nancy Haas from the County Attorneys Association is here.
Ms. Haas. Mr. Kingray.
Madam Chairman and members of the Conference Committee, my name is John Kingry, Executive Director of the Minnesota Counties Association. And Madam Chair, it's a long time since we've talked. It's nice to see you. And we are here because it is a continuation of a grant that we previously have been receiving. And in 2011, it was put in as a rider to transfer the funds from the Attorney General's office to the Department of Public Safety. In discussions with House staff, it's my understanding that they believe that that transfer, even though it was rider language in 2011, was a permanent transfer to the Department of Public Safety. In discussions with the Department of Public Safety, it's my understanding, and actually I've been told, that they do consider it to be a permanent transfer, and actually have asked us to start preparing a budget. So what we're asking for is clarity in terms of how we approach this going forward. Providing training for prosecutors is not uncommon around the country. Over half the states do provide some subsidy for prosecutor training, and it's our belief that well-trained prosecutors result in fairer trials, more expedient trials, and fewer appeals. And with that, Madam Chairman, Nancy Haas or myself would be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Kingray, Ms. Haas, did you remind us of this at our overview in the House?
Madam Chair, we did not.
Must have come up later?
Well, Madam Chair, it's really a reason, an interpretation issue. You know, as we understand it, you did not need to put it in your bill because it was thought to be ongoing. The Senate has it as a rider to be potentially to be sure that it's funded. And so really we're here to say which is the right way to go on an ongoing basis so that we have some clarity for next biennium, because this was transferred in the last biennium. Okay. So either way, Madam Chair, is correct. So that's why you didn't hear from us about it. But we're looking for your intent on a going forward basis.
And Representative Newton.
Is this something that the counties also budget for? Don't they budget for training for law enforcement and for prosecutors?
Mr. Kingery, or Ms. Haas.
Madam Chair and committee members, specifically for peace officer training, there are state funds that are available for that. This is specifically for prosecutor training, which also combine. We actually do training that involves law enforcement. But this is money that comes to us to train prosecutors and do it in partnership with law enforcement. There's a separate fund under the Post Board for peace officer training.
Thank you.
And how does the Attorney General, why does the Attorney General present the grant?
Madam Chair and committee members.
They're the prosecutors for the state?
This is just has been longstanding in their budget for 20 years.
Since the early
80s. The Attorney General a couple of years ago expressed an interest in having the money be transferred to someone who typically does grants like this, and that was the reason for the transfer to the Department of Public Safety and their Office of Justice Programs.
And is your Public Safety Committee?
Madam Chair, we don't have
jurisdiction over them.
No, who's our Public Safety Committee? Yeah, that's in Senator Dibble's committee. He has transportation.
Okay. Well, we'll see. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, the next provision is one that you already discussed quite a bit at the last meeting on the cash flow for OET, and so I won't go over that again. It's on page, I even have the page number wrong on that.
It's on R9.
Okay. At the very top of the page, thank you, Stephanie, is the Senate language that you discussed extensively last meeting. So moving on to the Department of Administration, at the bottom of page R9, there's a couple of differences. On the Nellie Stone Johnson bust, the House makes the appropriation contingent on an equal non-state match, and then there's a difference in how this would be approved by the Historical Society and the CAP Board. The House language requires following the process in some specified statutes, which would require both the CAP Board and the Historical Society to approve the placement of this bust. And the Senate has a little bit different language and says that the Historical Society and the CAP Board would apply existing guidelines for design and placement. That the Department of Administration would consult with those two and apply the existing guidelines.
Senator, I just wanted to tell you that the House language said bust or statue, because when they testified, the people that wanted this the bust or the statue in, they said they wanted something that related to children. And I thought that perhaps a statue might relate to children better than a guy's or a woman's head on a pedestal.
Yeah.
And so we would like to give the departments that are talking about this the utmost authority to relate to children.
Does that sound all right, Senator?
Certainly.
Bust or statue?
Sounds fine.
Okay, we can make that change.
But we know that statues cost more than busts.
Usually do.
We don't need to talk money tonight. Depends on who's doing it. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, the next provision on page R10 is actually one where the House or Senate, the House and Senate language is identical, but the Department of Administration has suggested a slight wording change, and it's on Senate lines 8.4 to 8.8, the in lieu of rent, House line 7.24 to 7.27. The department suggested that in whichever, when this language is adopted, they suggested deleting the word office in front of space costs, because they would like to use some of this money to store artifacts and other similar materials during the capital restoration process. So deleting the word office would give them more flexibility than the current language that's identical on both sides.
No problem?
That's fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll make that change. Get rid of office. Is that what you said?
And then they could just do what they store whatever they want. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, Wayne Wasowski with the Department of Administration. This would come into play for things like the fine art, the portraits that we have hanging, and also the chamber desks where when we're doing restoration work in House and Senate chambers, we'll need a place to store the chamber desks. So this will cover those types of costs.
Well, we certainly want to help in those things. Sure. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, the next change I noted is on Senate lines 8.16 to 8.18 on page R10, where the Senate language specifies the base. And I'm not sure if this is a real substantive difference or not, but I thought I would just point it out.
Anyone else want to talk about that? No. Okay. Go on.
And on, Madam Chair, on the next page, there, on R10 and 11, the Senate language referring to repair, rental, and purchase of equipment, I'm on lines 8.25 to 8.27. The equipment under $500 is listed under the Community Services Grant Rider. The House has the same language on the next page on 8.12 to 8.15, but has it under the Equipment Grant Rider. And so I think we may just need some advice from the people getting this to tell us where this language should best go.
Mr. Hansen.
Madam Chair, Tom Hansen from Winthrop and Weinstein representing Ampers. I think to Mr. Shepherd's question, I think that language is we would want it applied to the equipment grants rather than the community service.
Thank you.
All right.
Please continue.
And, Madam Chair, the House Community Service Rider on R10, lines 8.7 to 8.9, has additional language saying that the appropriation can be used to disseminate emergency information in foreign languages. And I don't believe the Senate has that language.
And then the third thing on there?
The last is on the following page, Madam Chair, on R11, Senate lines 8.31 to 9.5. The Senate has a rider on stations KOJB, KBFT, and KKWE.
Chair, those are the tribal radio stations.
And so you're identifying them by their titles.
Right.
Turning the page.
Madam Chair, the next provision is on the gambling control and racing. These are actually accounts that were not in the House bill. They came to us when some of the accounts were reallocated for conference committee. But on the House side, on page R15 and 16, both for the Gambling Control Board and the Racing Commission, the House has language that specifies in addition to the base for the upcoming biennium.
We need to know about this because we've never had it.
Yes. So, Madam Chair, the what we're talking about here is the 1% base adjustment.
Oh.
I think. Isn't that correct? Yeah.
Madam Chair, members, that's
Ms.
correct.
Ms. Roberts.
This does represent the 1% base adjustment, and the reason that you're seeing it here and not in the other agencies is a different style that the other finance committee used, but that's what it represents.
Thank you. Mr. Shepherd?
Madam Chair, turning the page to R16 on the Senate side, lines under the Indian Affairs Council at the bottom of the page, you'll notice the Senate has a rider that specifies an amount each year for a cultural resources specialist to assist the council with duties relating to Indian burial grounds.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Saxop.
I think that this has been in the budget from some previous budgets, so this isn't something new that just came up this year. That correct, Mr. Lundeen?
Yes, that is correct. It was a base rider we had in the budget bill last year.
Good. We have a testifier from Indian Affairs.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Ms. White, Indian Affairs Legislative Director. I've spoken with our Executive Budget Officer and the Executive Director, and we prefer not to have a separate appropriation because there's more than just a cultural resource specialist that is funded with our Cultural Resource Department. We have many contracts that are funded, and we have a large amount of artifacts that are housed at Hamlin that we have a large contract with in their osteology department.
Thank you very much. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, moving on to the Historical Society on page R17, there are three Senate rider provisions that aren't in the House side. The first one is on line 13.30 to 14.3, and that is a breakout of some money for education outreach. The second one is immediately below that. It is a breakout of money for the Minnesota Forest History Center. And the third one is down on lines 14.11 to 14.13, which is a breakout of money for a archivist staff position. On the House side, there's a rider that, I'll get to that one later. So that's it on the Senate side for the Historical Society.
And does the Forest History Center get funding through, all their funding through the
right.
Historical Society?
Madam Chair, this is over and above the base, and not always, no, but this is a separate appropriation for the the Forest History Center, which was called by the other side of the aisle, the Tree Museum in the Senate.
Really?
But anyway, we can talk about that. And the Military Museum, the reason that Senator Gazalka is asking for money for an archivist is that there's a huge backlog of military records at the Military Museum. And so this is apparently a short-term need that this needs to be processed.
And is that the Military Museum at Camp Ripley?
Yes.
And when people from Camp Ripley talk to me about additional monies, I think they were talking about being open more on Saturdays. Is that...
Do we have any... What do you... we may have to ask somebody to come down and talk to us.
But maybe Mr. The Historical Society knows Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, members of the Conference Committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. The Minnesota Military Museum is a pass-through or fiscal agent that's a separate organization from the Minnesota Historical Society. And those are organizations for which the legislature has asked us to just administer funding. We had a separate request, and I believe you have some information about that from the Minnesota Historical Society. That's the subject of a little bit of a difference in the two bills, and if you'd like us to spend a moment or two talking about that, we'd be happy to do that.
The Historical Society access education, that part?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Yes, and this money for the archivist then is in addition to your... what you talked to us about for education and access. And
Madam Chair, that's correct. The items that are in subdivision two of the two bills are programs that are operated by the Minnesota Historical Society, and subdivision three of the bill are fiscal agents. The archivist that's specifically mentioned under the Minnesota Military Museum is that organization's request. And Mr. Elliott has joined me at the table, so we'd be happy to discuss the main requests that we've brought forward.
Well, just remind us of what they were again.
Yes.
If there's questions, we'll ask them.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committees. I'm Steve Elliott. I'm the director of the Minnesota Historical Society, and appreciate the opportunity to address these requests this evening. You have a memorandum dated May 7, which outlines the needs for which this funding was being addressed by both the House and the Senate. Over the last many years, as we have tightened our operations, we have found that there are a couple places where our services, we think, you know, we cut muscle to bone, and the services are too thin for the citizens of Minnesota, given the investments we have in some of these historical resources. And so we submitted one request that would enable us to expand a little bit at some of the historic sites around the states, the hours that they're open to the public. And so some of this funding would enable us to move into those shoulder seasons at the Forest History Center and other locations around the state so that they're more accessible to the public to use. Those are wonderful times to travel, and we know people would take advantage of them. It would also be supportive of those locales in terms of attracting travelers and visitors and having that extra money into those local economies. We're also especially concerned about the level of services at the History Center Library. We We would love to be able for that library to be open every day that the History Center is open to serve people both here and those who travel some distance to come here to do research. And we would also like to increase a little bit the level of service we're able to provide in the library and behind the scenes in terms of the taking care of the collection and making sure that we're continuing to collect for posterity. And finally, we reduced way too far on the level of field services that we provide to local history organizations all around the state. Just today, we were visited by leaders from several local county historical societies, and you know, one of the things they talked with us about was how much they miss the readiness of what they saw as really exemplary service to them, and now it's not as readily accessible. And we just feel that helping to increase the capacity of local organizations is really important because they're serving people in their communities. And then the second category of expanding educational outreach, education is such an important priority for us. And with a new sixth grade curriculum about Minnesota coming out that we worked with the state ed department to develop, we published the textbook. We would love to do teacher workshops around the state to help teachers become familiar with that curriculum and how to introduce it in the classroom. It's especially important this year because Minnesota is now going to be taught in the sixth grade. It was banded before in fourth to sixth grade, so there will be some teachers teaching it for the first time. And much better to have workshops around the state than to have one or two in the Twin Cities and cross your fingers and hope and expect everybody will come here for them. Teachers also want very much for their youngsters to be able to become acquainted with going to primary sources and analyzing primary sources. We'd like to be able to prepare a number of primary source documents to supplement the curriculum for teachers and to build on our summer internship program especially for at-risk youth and those that we're helping visualize a way to college. So those are the needs that we would like to address with this funding. We are very appreciative that both the House and the Senate have responded, and of course, the more fully responsive both have, I think the better service we can provide.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kelleher. Is there somebody here that knows about the archivist? Thank you.
Madam Chair, I can just say that we've worked with the Military Museum. You walk down the hall to the flag cases in the rotunda. One of the staff people from the Minnesota Military Museum was sort of on loan to us as we did the preservation and restoration of those flags that are in the cases. So we've worked with them for many years. We don't have a ton of information on their specific requests, but as the fiscal agent passed through, we've worked with them and they do good work.
Yeah, I gathered that, but go on, Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, the next item on page R18 should be listed under the arts. It should say arts board there. It's not a historical society item. I omitted the arts board. And on R18 on the House side, lines 12.11 to 12.21, there's a rider that says that the money appropriated to the arts board and distributed as grants can be spent only on projects located in Minnesota. And then it says that a recipient of a grant must not use the money to travel outside Minnesota except up to 5% of the total grant, and that none of it can be used for travel outside the continental United States.
Okay. And that was a floor amendment, Mr. Senator.
Madam Chair, was it provoked by any particular situation? Or?
It was the article about money that had been awarded to an artist that went and made available to the community, the metro community, several times what that artist had learned. But it was far away.
It's a travel to the Pacific, wasn't there?
I can't remember. It was a Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, on page R19, under the Humanities Center is the next item on the Senate side. There's a breakout of a $50,000 grant for Everybody Wins Minnesota to operate a reading program for Minnesota children.
And Madam Chair,
this is
a Senator Pappas bill, and Mr. Anderson from Everybody Wins is here. Give us a brief testimony.
And Mr. Anderson also spoke to our committee.
Good evening,
earlier.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Marvin Anderson, and I'm the Executive Director of the Everybody Wins program. For the past 16 years, we have been in partnership with the state of Minnesota to offer reading and mentoring services to over 7,000 children in the city of St. Paul. The state of Minnesota is very unique in offering this service in that we read over the noon hour, and our organization in the St. Paul Public Schools have provided transportation to go to the 20 agencies that are involved in this program, to pick them up, to take them to the school, to wait till their reading session is over, and then to bring them back to their agency within 1 hour. For 16 years, Everybody Wins in the St. Paul School District have funded this program for the state of Minnesota. We were informed late last year that they can no longer participate in this program. The funding is on our shoulders. It wants the program to continue. We're looking for an appropriation that will give us an opportunity to find alternative sources of funding. We hope to apply to the United Way. We hope to apply to other foundations so that this program can continue to exist. We've read to over 7,000 students in the last 16 years. We've provided over 41 hours of volunteer time. The state of Minnesota has done this. This is the oldest program in our network. It's the only program of its kind in the country. And we're asking the state of Minnesota to stand by us for this next biennium. And we will find funding to keep this program, to continue this program, so that this program can be offered to the state of Minnesota employees and they can continue to work and provide this service. It's a proven method. The schools love it. The children love it. The community benefits from it. And we can't exist without the state of Minnesota employees working with us on this program.
Mr. Anderson, how did you arrive at the $50,000?
That's the cost of the transportation. We operate four buses, Tuesday, Wednesday, three days a week. We operate the buses that go to all of the agencies and pick up the volunteers. The majority of that money is the transportation cost that we contract with a private company to provide the bus services. The other part of the appropriation is for the coordinators who make sure they do the day-to-day operation of the program for the 3 days. They work about 4 hours a day, 4 to 5 hours a day, getting everything arranged, arranging for substitutes, arranging for to find other volunteers to come in when they can't make it if they have a meeting, to work with the schools on the curriculum, to work with the media center to provide the books so that when the volunteers arrive at the school, everything is set up for them. It's very efficient, and it can't be efficient unless we have somebody at each of the schools to provide this service. It's a two-year appropriation, and it covers all of our costs for those 2 years.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, the next item on the list, telecommunications access, should not be on the list. Mr. Lundin reminded me this has been transferred to another committee, so I think
Madam
that...
Madam Chair, it's Senator Tomasoni's committee, which would be Representative Mahoney's.
Okay. Mr. Shepard.
And Madam Chair, under Military Affairs on R24, the Senate has a rider providing a $200,000 grant to the USS Minnesota Commissioning Committee. It's on lines 18.1 to 18.16 on the Senate side of R24.
Madam Chair, have you heard this story yet?
I want to hear it again.
Okay. Well, this came to us through Senator Reinhart, who was part of the Minnesota delegation at the commissioning of the Minneapolis-St. Paul, which apparently was kind of embarrassing because we had virtually no representation for that commissioning. And so we have another ship now that's going to be the USS Minnesota, and this $200,000 would be to do whatever we do to end up with a delegation out there, I guess. That's the information. We can talk as a committee.
Please proceed, Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair, the last cluster of provisions is under the Veterans Affairs Department. Starting on R25, the Senate on the left-hand side of the page has a $750,000 a year breakout grant for the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. On R26, the House has funding for Veterans in Crisis de-escalation training. And then on R27 on the Senate side, on line 20.16 and 17, there's language under the GI Bill funding. The Senate has that rider that says of the amount of the funding, $100,000 is for transfer to the Office of Higher Education. And finally, at the bottom of that page, the Senate transfers $840,000 in the first year to the Minnesota Support Our Troops account.
Senator?
Well, on R25, we're looking for some clarification for the Veteran Services officers as to if they can use the money for other purposes other than what we've included in the rider. Do we have any? But you can speak to that.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Committee, I'm Kathleen Vitalis. I'm the CEO of Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans. And, sir, I'm trying to understand your specific question.
Well, on, let's see, where are we? R25.
I think the wording here, sir, is worded, we do have a 30-day residency for Minnesota citizens for this money. We work very, with the Department of Veterans Affairs about no duplication of services to make sure we're leveraging the dollars correctly. Homelessness and those in crisis.
Mr. Lundin, could you tell me, we have a one-time appropriation in there?
Yes, yeah. The way we structured the rider is there's $500,000 in the base, and we provided an additional $250,000 a year, one-time money. So that's why if you look down online, starting on line 19.25 and going to the end, the base is $500,000 a year for fiscal year 16 and $500,000 for fiscal year 17.
Ms. Vitalis?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have any additional information for us?
About the services that we perform at MACV? That we help? No, no.
No, just about the one-time thing?
Well, my understanding is, and sir, maybe you can, if I'm even remotely reading this correctly, and I may not be, because this is not what I do for my full-time job, I think the House has it that there is ongoing funding. Is that correct, sir? Yep. So that's why it's not showing up here, that the House has us getting this appropriation ongoing, the additional 250 added to the base of 500. The Senate is saying that this is a one-time for the biennium, the 250 added just for that biennium, and that we would go back to the 500,000 base, maybe at that point in time, coming back and giving, I'm assuming, an update as to what we're seeing and what's happening with veterans. Certainly, if you're asking me what I prefer, it would be the House version, Madam Chair.
Ms. Vitalis, so tell us what would happen. How you would deal with that one time rather than ongoing?
I have been, our funding has been very volatile I've been here 12 years, and so it's been going up and down and back, and at one point we were at $1 million, and then it got cut the next year to $500,000. So for the last 4 years, we've been in the base for $500,000. I've been coming each year, and the last couple of years we got $100,000 one time. And then I come back and I state our case, and it certainly has not been, there's always the need outweighs that funding that I'm receiving. So if the question, certainly in the next 2 years, can we use the $250,000? Yes. Can we use it beyond that? I believe so as well, with what we're seeing as our numbers are increasing right now with those in crisis and those experiencing homelessness. I think that it is going to be something that we're going to see for quite a few years.
Thank you.
Is that?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
This is a question for our testifier.
Thank you, Ms. Vitalis.
Thank you.
So we have a base of $500,000 a year, but it's only for the biennium. Is that what I understand, Mr. Lundin?
We have the base funding is $500,000, and that will continue into the next biennium in the base. But the $250,000 that we added each year will only be available for the 14 and 15 biennium.
And the House?
And the House put the $250,000 in each year ongoing, so it'll be in the base next time. The base, if we took their funding level, would be $750,000 in the base each year.
Good. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that.
Page. Mr. Shepard, the de-escalation training.
Madam Chair, on R26, the House provides that of the appropriation to the department, up to $100,000 each year can be spent for training state and local safety personnel in crisis de-escalation techniques for veterans.
this was something that we did not have jurisdiction over. A bill left our committee and then went to public safety, and yet when we were putting our bill together, the people that were advocates of having some de-escalation training given to their peace officers and first responders across the state, they felt that they would like, since nothing had happened with it in public safety, that they wanted us to address that, and this was our solution to addressing that kind of training. And the post board directors and the commissioner of Veterans Affairs both agreed to consider the proposal and see what they could work out.
Yeah, I think the money is, Madam Chair, I think the money's been in the Senate from previous years. Anything that you can add, Ms. Lundin?
I don't believe we have any funding for this in the base for Veterans Affairs. I think there was a bill in the Senate. I know we didn't see it in our committee. I'm not sure where it is. We can check on that and find out.
We'll do that.
Mr. Chair, and I serve on public safety, so we did hear it in that committee.
Thank you, Senator.
It's part of the transportation bill that's kind of a hiatus.
We all watched the decomposal.
I saw that tonight.
Okay.
There's some de-escalation.
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, on page R27, under the Minnesota GI Bill, on the Senate side, one of the topics that's included on line 20.13 is administering post-secondary educational benefits. The House doesn't have that phrase, and then the Senate has another rider sentence on 20.16 and 17 that transfers $100,000 of the appropriation for to the Office of Higher Education. And the fiscal staff may have some more information on that.
We'd appreciate hearing that.
Okay, I can address it. I think the $200,000 in each bill is referring to $100,000 the governor had in his budget for administrative costs for the Department of Veterans Affairs as we expanded the GI Bill. And in the base was another $100,000 that when the GI Bill was originally put in place a number of years ago. And that $100,000 is appropriated to the Department of Veterans Affairs, and they then transfer it to the Office of Higher Education. So I what we're trying to do in the Senate bill was just to clarify what that $200,000 represented, and that part of it was transferred and does transfer.
And so that's a continuation of what's been done?
Correct.
Okay. Any more information on that?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Roberts.
I would just acknowledge that I think the Senate's language is technically correct.
Fine.
And that I should have made that adjustment in the process.
Fine. Mr. Shepherd, R27.
Yep, Madam Chair, the last item is on the Senate side at the bottom of page R27, and that has to do with the $840,000 for transfer to the Support Our Troops account.
Mr. Lundin?
If you recall, in the governor's budget, he had a proposal with a scratch-off lottery ticket that was estimated to bring in $840,000. And the governor's budget bill set up a Support Our Veterans special revenue account, a new account. When we were putting together our bill, originally we did have the lottery language in there, but instead of going to the Support Our Veterans special revenue account, we figured we could put it in this account that is already existing, This account was set up a number of years ago. There's those Support Our Troops license plate revenue goes into it, and the agency uses it to provide support to veterans. So, and then when we were on the floor, we changed it just to a direct general fund appropriation that would be transferred into the Support Our Troops account.
Ms. Roberts, and we didn't do that, right, because we don't have license plates and lottery money, and so we didn't consider that, but we... Was there something for Support Our Troops?
Madam Chair, there wasn't a change in the House related to Support Our Troops. As Mr. Lundin said, there is existing funding from the existing license plates that goes both to Department of Military Affairs and Veterans Affairs, but as you noted, we didn't make any changes.
So this is additional money then from for Support Our Troops from what you were already doing?
Yes, this is a...
It's now a, it's general fund rather than the lottery or the license plates.
And Madam Chair, if you haven't already said it, or Mr. Lundin has, we're about $170,000 apart in terms of the money we both put in there.
Okay, thank you.
I think you're referring to the total funding for the Department of Vets Affairs, not just the Support Our Troops account. I believe that's roughly correct.
Including military affairs, too?
I think what Senator Saxog was referring to was the total amount of new funding that the House and the Senate kind of doing a comparison, not referring to the military affairs.
Point being, we aren't that far apart.
And some the target.
What's a target?
The amounts that we're going to get, huh? Or not? Okay. Mr. Shepherd, that concludes page 1 and 2. What about, are we doing the R7A3? Was that for tonight?
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Maybe I missed this because I got here just a couple seconds late, but R12 and 13, there's differences there, and we skip by those. Is there, I see one of it is the one that we're going to talk about later, but the first two, is that part of that same discussion for a later date? Enterprise-wide results in the enterprise human resource capacity.
Yes.
Those are part of the... Okay. Yeah.
Mr. Shepherd, you don't know what I'm talking about?
Madam Chair, I think you are referring to... I'm not sure what the... the R7A3 is provisions that were on yesterday's agenda relating to the Department of Administration.
Okay.
And so I...
Thank you. The next thing was then the CGIP. Thank you, Ms. Morocco. You've sent a couple different communications, and I have the impression, did you discuss do you know anything, Senator, do you know anything about what our CEGIP problem is?
A little bit, but probably a brief, Madam Chair, a brief synopsis would be helpful.
Representative McNamara brought to our attention the issue that people that didn't apply for their insurance or didn't follow all the directions of the insurance, some of them had costs involved when their insurance was canceled or they didn't meet the procedures that had been laid out through the documents that they had received or not received in the mail. And the Department of the CEGIP people were asked to work something out, and Mr. Morocco has been attentive to that task, but doesn't seem to be able to come to a satisfactory conclusion. And perhaps, Ms. Morocco, you can state how you were presented with it and what your attempts to have addressed the situation have been.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm director of the Employee Insurance Division, and thank you for the opportunity to talk more about this. You're correct in that we've had several conversations with many members, particularly Representative McNamara, who just had a very basic problem that he wanted to solve, and that was that he had a constituent that, for whatever reason, was unable to comply with the legislative mandated dependent audit, and he was looking for some solution. The challenge that we have is very technical, it's very legal, and it occurs on many levels. And we've had some of those very technical conversations with members. I don't know that we necessarily want to get that deep in here. So let me just try to represent the issue, at least one of the issues, in very simplistic terms, if I could. And as a health plan for state employees, we have to follow many laws, state laws, but mostly federal laws, and that's where we really do start to get tripped up. Keep in mind that the benefits for state employees are pre-tax benefits. That means we're talking about IRS regulations, we're talking about Department of Treasury, we're talking about ERISA plans, we're talking about COBRA, HIPAA, and really at the very basic level for those that get into these sorts of things, we're talking about the basic operating principles of cafeteria plans. And really one of the fundamental principles of a cafeteria plan is that you need to treat all the members fair and equitable. And I think that's a pretty basic concept in that if everyone is paying the same premium, whether you're a retiree, whether you're an active employee, whether you're receiving a full contribution, a partial contribution to the premium, we really have an obligation that if a premium is being paid, then the same kinds of services and the same rules need to apply equally and equitably to all the members within that group. So in no way do we want to be prejudicial to anyone within the program. So one of the nice things that the federal law allows you to do, or a cafeteria plan allows you to do, is it allows you a wide range of options in terms of how you want to set your plan up. You can have open enrollment if you want. You can decide not to have open enrollments. If you have a new hire, you can choose to give them 30 days to enroll. You can give them 60 days to enroll. The federal law allows you that kind of flexibility. But what it doesn't allow you to do is then to apply those rules in any kind of prejudicial manner, so that if everybody has a 30-day rule to enroll, you can't then arbitrarily pick somebody who might have failed to enroll as a new hire, as an example. If they were to miss that deadline, if you were to then extend that deadline for one employee, but choose for whatever reason, because you believe a situation is different, to not extend it for another, that would be prejudicial. And that's something that you can't do under a cafeteria plan. So now let's take that example into what Representative McNamara is trying to accomplish. What he would like to do is to financially reimburse members who were unable or unwilling to comply with the mandated audit. So now the question becomes, how do you apply that without prejudice? So if a member were to say, during that period of time when they had missed complying with the audit, if they had chosen to enroll in COBRA, for example, and they paid out of pocket, they enrolled in COBRA and they paid approximately $1,400 a month, then that reimbursement would be $1,400 a month. But what if another member within CGIP that was unable to comply didn't have $1,400 a month and chose to go without coverage? What becomes their reimbursement under this proposal? Equally, if someone were to choose another plan, let's say something in the middle, they went to the open market and they decided to buy a high deductible plan, had a low premium but had a very high deductible. So now what becomes their reimbursement? There isn't really any way to create a fair and equitable reimbursement for members who chose not to comply. So just on that principle alone, we are really struggling with trying to come up with some mechanism that would allow us, even if we were able to overcome a lot of the other technical issues, and there are many, and some of those, I've shared both Section 125 specific rules with somebody or laws. I've also referenced some Department of Treasury guidance in many other areas, which, again, if we could get past this, we would still have some other hurdles. But focusing just on this piece, we would be very challenged to come up with some mechanism, again, that would be treating folks fair and equitable. For the 98% of state employees who were able to comply with the audit, even for us to go and begin to reimburse others who didn't comply, even at that level, could be viewed as prejudicial. They did what they were asked to do. They were given 6 various notices. They were given 2 appeal periods. 1 appeal period specifically written in law after the audit was legislated. I think the following session, the legislators had some concerns that there might be some employees who wouldn't be able to comply with the audit, and specifically required the audit to have a very official appeal period. Now, in that example, because the audit had not completed, we were able to offer all participants an equal appeal period. So everybody, again, was treated fair and equitably. So the legislature did anticipate this sort of problem, and subsequent to passing the original audit law, had passed a subsequent law that required an appeal. That was something that we were able to comply with because, again, we were able to apply that to the entire group on a fair and equitable level. Once the audit is done, now to come back and to try to come up with some mechanism that would somehow reimburse people or would somehow undo the loss of coverage, that's now where we get into trouble. And again, I think just I'll stick with sort of the fair and equitable example, but we would have other barriers even if we could come up with a solution. We would be in violation of pre-tax laws. There are use it or lose it laws within Section 125. Make an election, you need to keep that election. There are certain periods of time where you can make changes. There are other times when you cannot make changes. This is creating sort of artificial points in time within the program that somebody is able to either get reimbursed or to come back on the plan, and you and I don't have access, for those of us who complied with the audit, we don't have access to those same options. So again, if we want to either formally here in the committee or offline, if any legislator would like to talk specifically about the IRS regs, Department of Treasury, Section 125, cafeteria plans, would be happy to have that discussion. However you would prefer, Madam Chair. With that, I'll proceed as you see best.
At one point in time, we were talking about the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Madam Chair, that is correct. We did look at that as a possible option. However, they would be placing us in a position of either following state law in violation of federal law, or if we were obviously to stick with a higher level of law being at the federal level, then we would be out of compliance, or we would essentially have to ignore what comes out of the Office of Administrative Hearings. So we couldn't find some way to, it wouldn't really be that much different than the legislature, frankly, passing a law that would put us in that exact same position of having to choose between state and federal law.
Sure. Representative Newton.
Mr. Morocco, what time frame are we dealing with from the time that the first notice went out until the time of the final appeal?
Mr. Morocco.
Madam Chair, the first notice went out on March 16th. The second notice went out on April 16th. The third notice went out on May 11th. The fourth second notice went also went out on May 11th. And then the official announcement for the appeal period went out on June 15th. And we actually do, we are still reviewing appeals, even though we sort of, we sort of consider this as sort of the audit is done, but that isn't necessarily true. There are some instances where if an employee does come forward, we are able to make some changes. There is a limited window or set of circumstances where it's possible, but that would be something like hospitalization or, you know, it would have to be pretty extreme, but there are some cases that we still continue to review. There are some documentation issues that we still continue to review. So, as an example, we have some members that say are unable to provide a marriage certificate because they may have been born in a foreign country, or they may not have birth certificates, you know, because they may be refugees or things like that. So. But essentially, to your point, the appeal period started on March 16th, lasted approximately about 4 to 5 months, but there are still some appeals that we are still continuing to review.
Representative Newton.
Just a follow-up on the specific case that Representative McNamara was talking about. Is that still under appeal?
Madam Chair, I would say no. I mean, based on the information that we have, if anybody at any time can bring additional information, new information, we will certainly review that. But barring any new information on that particular case, I do not believe there's an opportunity to, you know, to reinstate or provide any other form of compensation.
Representative Bernardi.
I was getting him up to speed on that, but it made me, Representative Newton may have asked this, but didn't we hear that, like, one person was out of the country, so it might have been a reason that they might have not have gotten it? Or, you know, are there any, have all those been appealed and addressed? Is there anything, like, that we, I just want to ask that question.
Sure.
Ms. Morocco.
Yeah, Madam Chair, this was a really difficult component to address. So we're getting a little bit more technical, but you know, if you look at laws related to health plan administration, and particularly COBRA laws are very clear on this. There's many there's case law out there that talks about what is the obligation of the health plan in terms of communication, and first class mail is really the only form of mail that stands up in a court of law. We talked about certified mail. That does not stand up in the court of law. And so really the obligation for members that are out of the country really falls to the member in the same way that any other document that might come to them at their known last address. So if someone were to leave the country, it would be their obligation to make you know, sort of, I guess, accommodations for that. What the health plan has an obligation to do is to ensure that that mail is delivered to the best last known address. In fact, we pay and see it. We pay to have mail returned back to us, and then we will further review why that might be coming back to us. We contact their HR offices, things of that nature. So, again, the obligation to the health plan is to ensure that it's delivered to the last known address. You know, whether it be a court summons, whether it be a visa bill, or in this case, whether it be a dependent audit, the obligation falls to the employee or the member to make sure that that mail is managed while they're out of the country. In this particular case, or in this audit, keep in mind that the audit is lasting well over 4 months. I think the presumption would be that some accommodation is needed to be made. I think for anybody, you know, leaving the country for that length of time.
Representative Bernardi, that you're okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
The Department of Administration, Mr. Allen, I understand you're here to talk about the procurement language.
Madam Chair and members, yes, I am. Thank you very much. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the Director of the Materials Management Division in the Department of Administration. And the sections that I would want to talk to you about are Article 3, starting with Section 4. Article 3. Article 3, Section
Just
4.
Hold on, yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm a little slow.
Just line 7.22 in the House.
There. Yep.
Okay. Would that be an R2?
So it's page R783.
Yes, Madam Chair, correct. Mr. Shepherd just pointed that out to me.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Sections 4 and 6 are actually designed to help us implement the new SWIFT system. And what these sections say is that we will be allowed to accept bids electronically. And I should probably say, as a way of prefacing all of this, all of these changes are relatively modest changes to the state's procurement law. And they're intended to streamline the process and use technology more effectively and to eliminate some non-value-added tasks. So sections 4 and 6 allow us to accept electronic bids, and these do not change the public information status of any data. It's simply changing the method in which we can accept bids from prospective vendors. And then Section 5, which you'll find on R10A3, I'm sorry. This redefines what it means to be a resident vendor in the state of Minnesota. There are a number of areas in Minnesota's procurement law when a Minnesota-based vendor receives an advantage. For example, if there's a tied bid, the winner will be the Minnesota-based business. Unfortunately, we found that the definition of resident vendor was defined so broadly that non-Minnesota businesses were qualifying for these advantages. And so what we've done here is to propose some language that more narrowly defines resident vendors to ensure that only businesses who actually are operating, paying taxes, and having a business address in the state would qualify for these advantages. And Section 7, which is on R11A3. I'm getting some coaching here from people that are keeping ahead of me, and I appreciate it. The intention of this one is to eliminate some paperwork that has been required in some very routine purchasing situations. The current language requires what's called a certification of certain factual conclusions with respect to the purchase of any service. And so with the language as it currently exists, agencies actually have to do paperwork with respect to getting a car wash or an oil change, advertising a job opening in the media. And what we're proposing is that below the level of a $5,000 purchase, you wouldn't need to do those certifications. When we work with agencies or consult with agencies regarding the annoyances to them in the state procurement laws, this usually tops the list. They really view this as sort of the least value-added paperwork that is required of them. Section 8 is R12A3, and what we've proposed here is raising the one bid level from $2,500 to $5,000. That means that you don't have to seek more than one price if you're purchasing below that $5,000 level. This threshold in the law hasn't been revised since 1998, and so we are proposing the change from $2,500 to $5,000. And then lastly, sections 8 and 10 and 11 are R13 through 15. What these would do is eliminate a requirement to advertise particular solicitations in the state register. Almost all public solicitations are now advertised online. In past years, there were requirements that things be advertised in the state register, which is available both online and in print. But the primary vehicle now for communicating business opportunities is no longer the state register. And so there are a handful of places in state law where that requirement to use the state register is still in place. And we're suggesting that those be eliminated so that there can be more consistency in where the notices to potential vendors are displayed. This is something we've discussed with the people who publish the state register, and they have no problem with it. So those are the issues that we have raised, and I'm very happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. The House did not hear that at the time that the site was put together. We have since passed it in a House file. I think we passed it. It's in the House file 866 that did not come to State Government Committee, but it's on the floor now. So it's caught up to us.
Madam Chair, and it matched up pretty well with Senate File 804, which was Senator Wicklund's.
That was quite a few pages, too, Mr. Allen.
I'm happy I could expedite that for you.
We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there any other business to come before us tonight?
So, Senator? Well, Madam Chair, exciting day for you tomorrow. We don't know what your timing's going to be. Assuming that at any time we do meet will be after you adjourn. And that being the case, when we do that, the key will be that we're going to have a presentation by the Compensation Council. So that'll be our number one priority, number one on the agenda, and anything else that we have after that, we'll take that. And thank you.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.